tremendous amount of mass in our atmosphere. When it's that thin, both in consistency and that thin in number of miles compared to the diameter of the Earth, it's very little. Let me drop. We got a few thousand pounds, or maybe even a million pounds, of meteorites that are falling on the Earth every day. From that, you would say, hey, our mass is continuously increasing. You could watch the shooting stars every single night, if you know what I mean, particularly during a meteor storm. So there's a lot of stuff hitting the atmosphere. And you say, boy, our mass is really increasing. Well, the atmosphere is also slowly boiling away, but it's being replaced. I think on a percentage basis, I haven't really researched this, but my gut feel, Mel, is that if I made a careful measurement by some means, and you can do it, of the mass of the Earth today and the mass of the Earth, let me pick a number, 500 million years ago, I think within a couple of percent it's identical. But there's a catch. Everything beyond synchronous Earth orbit that's in orbit around this planet is slowly spiraling outward. Everything inside of the synchronous orbit, 22,300 miles up, is slowly spiraling inward. That's the gravity hydrodynamics. The moon is slowly spiraling outward, something like a centimeter every year. A zillion years ago, the moon was at half the distance it is now. Where did the energy come from to do that? It's the slipping of the tide, the friction of the tide against the Earth. The tide leaves a little bit, and it slowly pushes the moon outward. Very similar to you put a ball on the end of a string, and you swing the ball around your head, and the way you move your hand adds energy to the ball and makes it swing faster. Well, the tides are doing that with the moon. Because the moon used to be a hell of a lot closer, the so-called 24-hour day of the Earth was a hell of a lot shorter. I don't know the exact number, but if someone told me the day used to be 16 hours long, I would believe it, and that's calculatable. You know exactly how much energy was added to the moon as it went from half its radius to where it is now, and that energy came from Earth.
Repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
And that energy came from Earth's rotation. There's no other place it could have come from. So the Earth is slowly decreasing in rotation rate. The day is slowly becoming longer as the moon moves out. And you get a very slight clue of that because of the fact that the National Bureau of Standards has to put in a leap second every so often to make the clocks come out right. But where do you think that that writer to you, Mel, was going when he asked about the mass of the Earth? Was he concerned about that creating a change in the rotational kinetic energy, the conservation of rotational energy? Therefore, that was the mechanism by which the days became longer as they are now. And the major constituent of that is the moon moving outward. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Oh, this is K2KEY. I guess the concern was that we're sending all this hardware out into space and that it's going to decrease the mass or the amount of weight of the Earth, making it lighter or whatever. But in other words, with all this, if we were to really, I could say, he started really sending things into outer space some years ago. Up to that point, would you say that the Earth, in other words, was a certain weight because that stayed constant because, like you say, the visiting of pieces of meteorites and whatever and the gravitational pull of the moon and all. In other words, if we do it on a micro level, is all this hardware that we're sending out of our envelope changing the weight of the Earth, basically, Dick, if we could put it on a scale over?
DC2, QAQ with a comment?
There's a yes and a no, but now you got to look at magnitude. The mass of the Earth is 6 times 10 to the 24 kilograms. So in other words, 6 with 24 zeros after it, kilograms. Mankind has launched into space, I'm going to pick a number, 100,000 pounds, not counting the International Space Station. The real launches into space, I'll be amazed if we've launched more than 100,000 pounds of stuff. That's 10 to the 4 kilograms, out of 10 to the 24 kilograms, 10 to the 5 kilograms. It reminds me also of another calculation I did. Orders of magnitude give you a real good clue. The BP spill was putting a few million gallons of oil into the Gulf of Mexico every single day and did it for 3 solid months. The total volume of the Gulf of Mexico is 10 to the 17 cubic meters, I think it was, or was it gallons? I think it's 10 to the 17 gallons is the total volume of the Gulf of Mexico. And they put something like 10 to the 10 gallons of oil into it. Maybe it's 10 to the 11. So there's one molecule per million of oil in the Gulf of Mexico, per million molecules of water. One per million, rough number. From that point of view, if every bit of it hadn't been dispersed and eaten up by bacteria and skimmed away and whatever, one per million, one part per million, doesn't sound quite so bad. Yeah, but a great big blob of it, let me drop it. If a great big blob of it winds up on your particular seashore and coats your particular favorite pelican and makes it, or your favorite turtle and makes it really look terrible and maybe even makes it die, yes, that's without a doubt a kind of a disaster. But in the big picture, when you've got all of that bacteria and all that plankton in the Gulf of Mexico eating that organic material, they think it's food. You've got dispersing going on, which is basically soap suds, a reasonably inert material, although you can try to convince yourself it's a terrible contaminant if you want to. I don't think it's that bad. So one part per million, roughly, Gulf of Mexico. And now, when it comes to the amount of stuff we put in the space compared to the mass of the Earth, I think it's one part in 10 to the 20. So did we launch a significant amount of mass? Yes. What percentage of the Earth? Wow. Is that an extremely small percentage? And the Earth is slowly gathering material because of all the meteorites. So I don't think it's a big concern. It's a cute academic interest is one way of looking at it, Mel. Glenn, you want to make a comment on this? KC2QIQ, K2RIW?
Sure. I think the answer to this one's easier. I'm pretty sure the Earth's getting a lot heavier. And the reason I'm going to base that on is if you look at just even fossil fuels that we burn in terms of pounds in one day and how many thousands of pounds of fuel we burn in one day, and we convert that into energy. But that weight is actually lost because you are burning it, but it's converted into energy. But then again, we replace it with the sun's daylight every day, and we're growing trees and forests and just life generally on Earth. So I think when you do the overall math on this one, it's going to weigh out way farther into the heavier mass just associated to the sun's energy being added to the Earth. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
WGB.
John recognized, but Glenn, I got a problem. One of the very famous experiments, done a whole lot of time, is you take burnable materials, matchsticks, wood, plants, whatever, oxygen and whatever, put them into a nice, clear plastic box that's 1 cubic meter, and the box is sealed, and you carefully weigh it. You stop the fire inside, and you burn up all the oxygen, and if there was enough oxygen to begin with, you burn up all the materials that you've got inside of that box. When you weigh the box at the end of the burning, you cannot detect the difference in weight of the box. Yes, energy was given off, and yes, by E equals MC squared, there is a change of mass. But the total amount of energy that was given off compared to the amount of energy available by E equals MC squared, the ratio is so huge that the scale you and I use on that closed box experiment, you will not be able to measure a difference in the weight of that box when you burn all that material inside of that box. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Oh, I completely agree, Dick. That's unquestionable. I mean, the only thing is just using that as an example, because the atmosphere is relatively open, and not all of those gases do get trapped. They do eventually, some of them do escape as they go up, and we are boiling up some atmosphere. But I would say that just in general, the sun's energy on the Earth and the life that takes place from it, it's not going to weigh out in terms of, in the end, of an equal. I mean, certainly the sun's energy is going to convert to life on Earth, and that life is going to have mass. So I'd say it's definitely increasing. I mean, I'd have to look into it a little bit further and see if there's real numbers attached to that someplace, but I would suggest that the mass is increasing just due to the fact that the amount of energy from the sun that's being added to the surface of the Earth is far more of the energy than we're using, period. I think you'd have to agree with that one.
Okay, the sun is giving us roughly 1,300 watts per square meter at high noon on a sunny day. And if by equals mc squared, I convert that to mass. That's extremely small compared to the solar wind. The sun is increasing our mass. You're right. But it's doing it by solar mass expulsion. A tremendous amount of material is boiling off the sun. It's called the solar wind. It moves away from the sun at roughly a million miles an hour. And great big globs of it happen at times, and it causes an aurora borealis. And the Earth's magnetic field channels that into the North Pole and the South Pole. Thank goodness we got that magnetic field. Otherwise, that solar wind would be peeling away our atmosphere. That's what happened to Mars. That's why how Mars lost all of its atmosphere. It got peeled away because it doesn't have a magnetic field. So the sun is adding mass to the Earth. I think 99.99% of it is due to solar wind, not due to direct energy conversion. The equals mc squared jazz, such a tiny amount of mass gives you so darn much energy, or vice versa. The amount of energy, 1,300 watts per square meter, you and I can calculate what that is in nanograms per year, if you know what I mean. It's small. The solar wind and the meteorites is giving us a whole lot. But John's going to give us a better answer on all this. Go right ahead, John. K2RIW in the tech net.
Good evening, Dick. Mel, everybody on the net. Dick, I just want to make a quick comment on what you and Paul were discussing before about the Dawn mission. I believe that's going to use gravitational attraction and decreasing elliptical orbits to stabilize its rotation around that unit. But you brought up an interesting point. How are they going to go on from there with that QRP engine? I hope we can find that out. Back to the net.
Believe it or not, John, that's the part that I accept. Once you're in orbit around those two asteroids, I had their names here in a minute. I'm darn forgetful on that. There it is. Ceres is the first one. Vista. Vista first and Ceres second. When you first go in orbit around Vista, and by some magic you get there, and you want to leave Vista, just by blasting the ionic engine in the direction to speed you up, I don't care how many orbits around it's going to take to do it, eventually you've got enough velocity to leave Vista. So leaving, there's no big hurry on leaving. You can take your own sweet time, slowly expanding your velocity, which means you slowly make the orbit bigger and bigger around Vista, and eventually you leave Vista. I accept that one. But whenever you approach any other heavenly body, that by definition, that heavenly body you're approaching has got a huge mass concentration compared to your puny little rocket. Therefore, it falls like a rock toward that massive body. And even if it's a glancing blow, you're way off to one side, so to speak. Under normal circumstances, you're going to whiz by as if you were doing a gravity assist maneuver. But to enter orbit, because you're falling into that gravity well and it's speeding you up, until you find some way, a very short period of time, slowing down when you're as close as you can get. If you don't slow down real fast, you ain't in orbit around that other heavenly body. You're going to go whizzing by. Getting into orbit is a very difficult procedure. When Paul's going to tell us the name of the spacecraft that I should know that just went into orbit around Saturn, it had to blast its chemical rocket for a long period of time, a tremendous amount of thrust, when it finally got to Saturn in order to get into orbit around Saturn.
Dick.
What was that again?
Cassini.
So when the Cassini object got into orbit around Saturn, I think it blasted an extremely strong chemical rocket for like 20 solid minutes to do enough deceleration in order to get into orbit. Is that approximately what took place, Paul?
I think it was more like 40 minutes. It was a real long burn. But yeah, you're right there. But Dawn definitely is going to use its ion rocket to slow itself down. It doesn't have a chemical rocket on board to do that.
Does it have any kind of reaction control jets, to your knowledge, Paul? Go ahead.
I believe it probably does, but I don't know. I got these, what is it? Like little gyro things to keep itself stabilized. You know, it is spinning. But I don't know. We'll have to look into that. But I'm telling you, that thing is, and you said for months, that rocket fires for years. It could go nonstop. It never stops firing. I mean, they can stop it, and they have stopped it, and then they start it up again. But yeah, that's all they're using is the ion rocket.
Okay, then there must be a very wide sweeping orbit when they first approach Vista. Must be way off to one side, because you fly close to Vista as you approach it. You're falling into a gravity well, you're speeding up real fast, and when you go by the planet, you would whiz by it. They're doing all that with an ion engine. As you go to the website, that part is not made clear. I went to page after page on Dawn, and I couldn't find out how they're getting into orbit around Vista. Got any further comments on this one, John? Go ahead.
WGB. Yes, Dick, I was just wondering the accuracy of the insertion point for that orbit to be able to achieve the elliptical part and then have it decreasing. And then I'd like to know how long they're going to have to burn that little QRP ion engine to get out of the orbit, and how long will it take to get to the next asteroid. That's going to be interesting, too. I didn't read about that.
I think it's something like 333 days, I'm looking at the website right now, until it approaches Vista. And it's going to be at Vista for, I think, something like a year. And I think two or three more years are required to go to a Ceres. So it's a fairly long mission. And each one of these objects that go in orbit around is going to be a polar orbit. And the object itself turns in the conventional manner. So the combination of the polar orbit and the rotation of the object allows you to view essentially all sides, measure its mass concentrations and local gases and all kinds of things. So it's going to be a rather interesting measurement of some of the very early pristine bodies of this particular solar system. Okay. Mel, do you have anything further before we go back to our question pool? Anything further that you want to say about, I keep forgetting the poor man's name, Ed Weatherhold, W3NQN, and his article. I was unhappy with it at first, but as I dug into it, he's right, but he is, he's going to be fighting an uphill battle. I've been saying for some time, we really should talk about reflected power ratio and reflected voltage ratio when we talk about standing wave ratio, because we never measure standing wave ratio with a slotted line anymore. We use directional couplers inside of a vector network analyzer, and we really measure reflected voltage ratio and reflected power ratio. So it's just we keep talking about VSWR for voltage standing wave ratio for traditional reasons. We never measure it anymore. It's time we drop it. But we have to keep instructing our students about what VSWR stands for, because in the real world, they're going to keep encountering it. I could say that we should abandon VSWR. It's an uphill battle, and your
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
It's an uphill battle, and in your and my lifetime, it's not going to happen, Mel. K2KEY, and he's got the same problem. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Precisely. Actually, what I was more or less visualizing, the easiest way to me to visualize is because I'm very familiar with return loss bridge. I would assume, can we use a return loss bridge basically as the crux for this argument, Dick, over?
Now, let me hit you with a sad state of affairs. I could be wrong on this, but I think I've got a pretty strong feeling that a return loss bridge is a fancy name for a classic object that really is a directional coupler. You may think it's a Wheatstone bridge. It is just another embodiment of a directional coupler. It is a device that's capable of differentiating between the forward flowing power and the reverse flowing power on a transmission line like system or on a load. So I think it really is a directional coupler, a vector network analyzer, and your bird wattmeter are both very fancy directional couplers. That's all they really are. Back to you, Mel.
Hey, yes, I will. I will agree with you. In fact, I was saying further that a directional, a return loss bridge, can also be considered as a hybrid combiner. You agree with me? Over.
Yeah, when you analyze what's going on inside of a directional coupler, you can build a directional coupler in the mini circuits manner, which when you look at it as a schematic diagram, it is a primary winding and a secondary winding of a transformer with the right kind of intercoupling of capacitors. You set up a transformer-like device with capacitor coupling. In other words, you can make a directional coupler out of lumped L's and C's. Or you can do it in a distributed manner in the way that NADA does it on their strip line directional couplers. Or you can build it in a distributed manner on what goes on inside of a waveguide, broad wall coupler, narrow wall coupler, or Bethe hole coupler. So you can distribute it with waveguide, strip line, tri-plate strip line, or make a lumped circuit equivalent with L's and C's and build it as what looks like a Wheatstone bridge. Every one of those things have something in common. You are phase-canceling signals in one direction and phase-adding them in the other direction. That's where the directivity is coming from. So you're coupling signal and worrying about the phase and making it co-phase in one direction and making it anti-phase in the other direction, and you've got directivity. So there's lots of ways of skinning that particular cat. But when you get down to the real theory of operation, they have an extremely strong similarity. Let me drop for a second. When a person first studies a directional coupler, the fact that you can build something in the middle of a transmission line that allows you to sample some of the signal, that's easy. You can sample some of the signal that's going forward, that's easy. And you can set it up so it will not be contaminated with the signal that's flowing backwards. You say, wow, that sounds like a violation of reciprocity. Sounds like a violation of reciprocity or conservation of energy or whatever. You dig deep enough and you find out it's no violation. It's real. And it's lossless. In other words, you add up all the power that flows through and the power that gets coupled or the power that goes to the dummy load. Everything adds up. It obeys conservation of energy. It's a beautiful thing. Directional couplers are extremely poorly described in all of the courses that the average student takes in electrical engineering school, even though he's favoring wireless circuits. It's an extremely important component. It is the heart of a vector network analyzer. And vector network analyzers these days and some spectrum analyzer functions are really doing the magic and letting you know everything you wanted to know but were afraid to ask in the past. And once you learn how a directional coupler works, let me drop, and you find out it doesn't have that much magic, and once you take the tri-plate strip line or the strip line version of one and realize that even though it is rated for performance at 8 to 12 gigahertz, and you can take that 8 to 12 gigahertz guaranteed directional coupler, and with a little bit of smarts, you can use it at half the frequency, a quarter of the frequency, a tenth of the frequency, 1% of the frequency. I personally have taken a 10 gigahertz directional coupler and used it at 10 megahertz. I have used it 1,000 times lower in frequency. It gave exactly the performance I could predict ahead of time, and it kept its directivity. You tell that to the average student or college professor, and he'll say you're crazy. Once you understand the theory of operation and what's going on, it does magic. Those directional couplers have been sold for years and years at flea markets for prices like $5 because nobody knew what they were. When you know what it is, it's got a hell of a lot more value. K2KEY, K2RIW.
You're 2TTT.
Ed recognized, but Mel first. Go ahead, Mel.
Exactly. In fact, I bought one that commercially was selling for about $500. And I bought it also. The guy literally, the guy said to take it, you know, almost. I said, let me give you a couple of dollars for it. He didn't know what it was laying on the table. He said, I have no idea what this thing is used for. Anyhow, what I was saying, I was really trying to equate a return loss bridge as it is with a number of the terminology that Ed Weatherholt was holding. And I'm talking about a return loss bridge that is a classic one, as you mentioned. RF input port, a load output port, and a type of toroid that's got a small transformer-like bifilar winding in it that goes to your detector, Dick. This is what I'm working with and how I was trying to equate certain aspects of it over.
And once you understand the theory of operation, there isn't so much magic there, but very few books do a very good job of explaining it. No course that I've ever heard of explains it correctly. What I know about a directional coupler was taught to me by a little old, real seasoned electronic RF engineer at Airborne Instruments Laboratory, starting in 1965. Hank Keane, Henry Keane, W2CTK was his call letters at the time. Whiskey 2, Charlie, Tango, Kilowatt. Taught me what happens inside of a directional coupler. And I said, wow, that's magic. It all happened because I'm sitting at my desk and I'm hearing this high voltage snapping sound. Across the hall, he had set up a piece of L-band waveguide in a directional loop. He was resonating it, feeding it with a magnetron, a pulse magnetron. He was putting in a couple of hundred watts of power. Because the loop was circular and resonating, he was generating something like 50 kilowatts of energy inside of L-band waveguide and arcing it over. He was making the power inside the resonant waveguide that high it was arcing over. That was the snapping sound I was hearing. He was doing that as a way of testing his rotary joint that had to survive 50,000 watt pulses or whatever it was. And he started explaining this stuff to me. There was a guy who had been through the apprenticeship of the hard school of Knox to learn it because the schools didn't teach it, and he became the rotary joint expert of that company, and they sold an awful lot of other things. I know I've gotten you off subject, Mel. You wanted to make a point. Let me pick up Ed because he's usually on the road, and he's going to be out of range real fast. I wonder how much of all this jazz you heard tonight. W2, Tango, 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 K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hey, it's Dick. Hey, Dick. It's Gordon here. Good morning or good evening still. I think the PL is 136 here. I just want to make sure I have that right. But in the meantime, my question about directional couplers is twofold. One is, how do you derate, how do you predict, if you will, the performance of, let's say, a 10 gig coupler at 100 megahertz or 10 megahertz or whatever? What is the general characteristic difference that you'll see as you make an excursion lower in frequency, number one, directional coupler? And number two, what do you do, is there a difference in the power handling capability? That was the other question, I guess. And number three, you might want to quickly review for some folks, you know, how a directional coupler is in fact directional in nature. How does it derive that? I mean, I know how to build a little tap of a, you know, 1N34 diode or whatever else, you know, when I want to make an SWR bridge, but what is it, if you're trying to feed that signal into a spectrum analyzer, for instance, or feed it into, you know, a watt meter, what are the differences that you have to consider when you're doing that? Or even just a regular oscilloscope, you want to, you know, what are the differences, you know, to consider? So that's a lot of questions. K2RIW, good evening, Dick, W2TTT. Very
fine, Gordon. You sound good from your mobile. And sorry I called you Ed by mistake. I haven't talked to you for a while. And I'm forgetful of names, as you can tell. And you got the right PO. You sound good for the machine. What happens with the directional coupler used out of frequency? It runs at much, much higher power. I had just written my article on the strip line amplifier tripler for 432 and 2 meters, submitted it to Ham Radio Magazine. Jim Fisk said, how do I know all the frequencies that are coming out of this thing? Have you measured all the other frequencies? Well, to do that, I needed a directional coupler into a dummy load that could take 300 watts. I go to my instrument lab at Airborne Instruments Laboratory and say, show me your 300-watt rated directional couplers. And he says, you're crazy. None of them are rated for more than 10 watts. And you don't stand a chance. I said, whoa, wait a minute now. Let me see what you got. And I had just talked to Hank Keane. He told me how a directional coupler works. I knew I was making a measurement at the 144 megacycles with the high power. They had a directional coupler at 10 gigs. At 10 gigs, that directional coupler was rated for 10 watts. And therefore, when I calculated what it could do at 144 megs, I think it was good for 5,000 watts because the directivity, the directional, the coupling coefficient goes down in a very predictable manner. What is that predictable manner? Let me drop. Going to have to try to give this to you briefly because this in itself is it can be an elaborate subject. First of all, you accept the fact that Mother Nature always thinks in voltage. Mankind may think in power and dBs. Mother Nature always thinks in voltage. Burn that into your brain, number one. Number two, a directional coupler. The directional line gives you best coupling when it is 90 degrees long, one quarter wavelength long. Sine of 90 degrees is one. The coupling coefficient is a sine function. If my directional coupler is 90 degrees long at 10 gigahertz, and it's got the exact same physical length when I go down to one-tenth the frequency, if I go down to 1 gigahertz, for instance, what used to be 90 degrees long is 9 degrees long. Take the sine of 90, compare it to a sine of 90, take the sine of 9, compare it to the sine of 90, that ratio, I don't know what exactly the number is, let's assume it's one-tenth. And I take the log of that and multiply it by 20 because it's voltage, I get 20 decibels in my example, less coupling at 1 gig than I do at 10 gigs. So what you think is a 10 dB coupler at 10 gigs is a 30 dB coupler at 1 gig. And it keeps its directivity as you go all the way down. And you can confirm that. The only slight catch now as you go down in frequency is it's falling off exactly 6 dB per octave. It's not flat. But since it's behaving in such a predictable manner, in a deterministic manner versus frequency, you know exactly what it's going to do. That makes sense so far, Gordon. Back to you, Gordon.
Yeah, sure. Very cool. To this map.
So,
what was the question?
So once you know the law, that it behaves in a sine manner, if you plotted the output of a directional coupler on your network analyzer as you swept it DC to light, the output coupling in voltage would look like a rectified sine wave. It starts off at zero, goes up to a peak at 90 degrees of length, goes back down at 180 degrees length, comes back up at 270 degrees of length, and so on. Unfortunately, when you go beyond 90 degrees, it no longer has directivity. You can't go up in frequency. But when you go down in frequency, it falls off with that rectified sine wave voltage waveform in a very deterministic, predictable manner. And as long as they've done a good job of building the dummy load inside, it goes all the way down to DC, falling off exactly 6 dB per octave all the way. Therefore, you can take a high-frequency directional coupler, use it at a lower frequency. What you think is a 10 dB coupler is a 40 dB coupler, and you can put kilowatts into it instead of watts. It keeps its performance that you care about. If you're testing that higher power, you don't need a whole lot of coupling. You want the opposite of a whole lot of coupling, because the front panel of your spectrum analyzer can't tolerate more than a watt before you burn it out. W2TTT for any other comments. K2LIW on the TechNet.
Okay, just to review real quick. I mean, I got all the principles going here. So sine 90 of the operating frequency over sine of the wavelength part. Sine of the wavelength, the operating frequency, sine of the design frequency over... Try that again. Sine of the
of the design frequency over sine of the operating frequency at ratio, and then 20 log of that, and away you go. You've got it. And when you use that formula on the directional coupler in your hand, and you calculate that it should have 43 dB of coupling instead of 10 at your particular frequency, and you measure it, the 43 will be 42.9. You say, close enough. It's within the ballpark of measurement accuracy, if you know what I mean. This secret I just gave you is not told anywhere in the world, and you'd be amazed how many people can be saved a hell of a lot of grief if they know it. As such, whenever you've got a transmitter that you ever built or touched or bought or servicing or whatever, and you would have put a little sampling port on the back panel so that you can sample the power that's coming out of the transmitter, for you to construct a little piece of wire alongside of the center conductor of the transmission line inside the box so that you sample some of the power, and you can set it up so it samples the power going forward, if that's what you want to know, or sample the power coming back if you want to know what standing wave ratio the transmitter is being subjected to, and you bring that out to a meter on the front panel, or bring it out to a connector on the back panel and bring it to your meter, you can easily put forward and reverse power sensing into any transmitter you own once you understand the principle. Ain't that magic? W2TTT, K2LIW.
T2QAQ with a comment?
You have now a question and a comment on this thing, Dick. This is awesome. Thank you. That, what a great, simple explanation that I can actually use. K2RW, W2TTT. I'll continue to listen. I'm here.
Now, I didn't tell you what goes on inside of that simple directional coupler to give it its directivity. The coupling line is parallel to the main line. It's a quarter wavelength long. It has both magnetic coupling and capacitive coupling. The magnetic coupling picks up some signal, and on your coupled line, one end becomes positive and one end becomes negative, so to speak. That's the magnetic coupling. The capacitive coupling makes both ends positive at the same time. The capacitive coupling makes both ends positive at the same time. Therefore, they add together on one wire, on one end of the coupled line, and they cancel on the other. That's, in very simplistic terms, the mechanism of the directivity. You increase the directivity by making those two ratios correct, the capacitive coupling ratio and the magnetic coupling ratio, which is a function of line width and line spacing. Get that right, and you've got directivity. And when it comes to directional couplers, the best example I can think of, let me drop, is that real good directivity couplers that you can buy these days, all of them have 15 to 20 dB of directivity, if the manufacturer has any real pride. That's a good one. An excellent one has 30 dB of directivity. A metrology grade has 40 dB of directivity, because it was very carefully tuned. I have in my hand a directional coupler, waveguide type, that I bought at a flea market for $3. Made by Singer Alford, probably in the year 1970. Very elaborate looking little thing. I paid $3 for it. It probably cost $5,000 brand new. From 8 to 12 gigahertz inclusive, it has 50 decibels of directivity. This thing is a CW radar. Put a good feed on the front of this thing and aim it around the room and look at the reflected signal with 50 dB of directivity. I can look at all the reflections around the room by watching the screen jump up and down on the spectrum analyzer as I aim it at various things.
I use it for 10 kilohertz.
Can't go down to 10 kilohertz. Waveguide is cut off. This is a waveguide type. The kind that works at the, standby now, that works as tri-plate strip line, will it work at 10 kilohertz? Yes. But it might have 100 dB directivity, 100 dB coupling coefficient. You can calculate it by that formula I gave you. And I'll do that maybe in the next half hour or so. I know that Glenn wants to make a comment on all this. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Yes, it's a very interesting point that you're bringing up, certainly as you go down in frequency on the couplers, that the coupling coefficient is going to go up, you know, so because basically there's less signal being coupled as the frequency is going down. Now, it's an interesting point that, let's say if you have a low-power coupler at, say, at 10 gigahertz, and then you want to drop it down to 1 gigahertz, 1,000, and you have an increase in power capability of 20 dB more coupling. Now, the problem that I see happening is that little coupler might have like SMA connectors on it. Don't you also have to be careful that, if, in other words, if you're going to pump the power up another 20 dB, that the connectors and the strip line are able to handle the power level? That would be my next concern, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Assuming that W2TTP. You're right on, Glenn. And lucky to me, that 10 gig directional coupler made by NADA had type N connectors on it. And type N connectors, reasonably carefully used, are good for 1,000 watts. And I was testing a 300 watt transmitter. If I was testing a transmitter with a directional coupler made with SMA connectors, you're absolutely right. You go beyond approximately 50 watts with an SMA connector, and you're pushing your luck at microwave frequencies. So, and by the way, all connectors, when they fail, with rare exceptions, coaxial-type connectors, fail by current density of the semiconductor overheating it. Therefore, your SMA connector, which can barely take 50 watts of CW power, will probably take 5,000 watts in pulse power, as long as the pulses are brief enough. So there's a way you can skin the cat, so to speak. If you've got to test a high power transmitter, and you've only got an SMA connector, if your transmitter is capable of being fed pulses of RF instead of steady state, you can still make the measurement. Over to you, Glenn. Kate?
Question.
Over to you, Glenn.
Yeah, right on, Dick, absolutely. Yeah, I played a little bit on the radar, too, there for a while, a few years back. Let me hand it over to Wesley. I think he's got a couple of questions. KC2QIQ.
Yeah, I'm doing Wesley's calculation. Go ahead, Wesley.
Okay, well, I have my questions unanswered, but the question that I have about direction coupler is, what is the highest written frequency on the direction coupler with the BNC connectors on it that would be good for 10 kilohertz still? Back to you.
Okay, I just did a calculation. If I started off with a directional coupler that is rated for 1 gigahertz, and I used it at 10 kilohertz instead, its coupling coefficient would be 100 decibels weaker. So if it was a 10 dB coupler at 1 gigahertz, it'll be 110 dB coupler at 10 kilohertz. So you probably, 100 dB of extra coupling is kind of a lot. So maybe you don't want to start off with a 1 gigahertz coupler. Maybe you want to start off with a 100 megahertz coupler. That'll make it 20 decibels stronger, minus 80 be added, and so on. Once you understand the way the sign of small numbers works, they start working in a linear manner, and it's just the ratio of, you could say it's the ratio of frequencies. If you know the design frequency and you know the lower frequency you're using it at, and you take that ratio and make sure it's a number less than 1, multiply it by 90 degrees, because at the design frequency your coupler is 90 degrees long. If it's a coaxial type or a strip line type, not a waveguide type, and then take the sine of that number, take 20 log of that, and you'll know what the extra decibels of coupling coefficients are. And if it's well designed, it keeps all of its directivity all the way down to DC. Just that it falls off at exactly 6 dB per octave all the way, so to speak. Now, does that make some sense, Wesley, at 2XJN, K2RIW?
Yes, it does. Actually, I have two of the direction coupler with the BNC connectors made by Mini Circuit. ZDC-10-1, and this one has the screws on it. I have to take the screws out and find out what is inside. For curiosity, back to you.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that, Wesley. If it is a coaxial type or wave, if it is a strip line type, because the strip line type gives you the tightest coupling when the coupled line is exactly quarter wavelength long electronically, with the velocity factor of the material, in other words. So the coupled line is parallel to the main straight through line on a strip line type or triplate strip line type.
many, many of the mini circuits directional couplers that operate at low frequencies are transformer type. Might not be true. Maybe yes, maybe no. A little more care is going to be required to find out if a transformer type, a lumped type LC directional coupler, still behaves this way. I know for a fact that the distributed type with strip line, not in waveguide, strip line or micro or triplate strip line, definitely do this. And now, I think you're about to ask the question, does the lumped type with transformers, does it also behave this way? That's going to require a little bit of special investigation. But I know a man in Queens who has the test equipment that can confirm that. Over to you, Wesley.
That was a good one. Okay. We don't have too much time, but I want to, with your permission, use it to answer just these two questions remaining. We're not going to the free energy today.
Yeah, let me double check with Mel to make sure I'm not forgetting something, and if so, we're about to go back to you, to Wesley. Mel, have we almost caught up? K2KEY, K2RIW?
This is K2KEY. I was going to get into what the original discussion was return loss, and I was going to delve into some examples. The directional coupler that I was able to pick up, yes, it comes calibrated very nicely, and it gives you a nice range of its dB, directional and dB, to measure the bridge directivity from 2 megahertz to 146. But what I was really going to get is the crux of making measurements with it in actuality. That's what I'm basically going to talk to you about, because as I refer to the article, over.
And now that you and I have had an extremely minor top-level discussion about what Mr. Weatherhold, Ed Weatherhold, W3NQN, is saying, do you and I somewhat agree with him that he might be right, but he's going to have an uphill battle? He's not going to be, he's not going to die happy on this one, where everybody jumps on this bandwagon. It's going to be a tough road between now and then. But once we accept his concept, I think his concept is basically right. It's going to be very tough to sell. What do you think, Mel?
That's it. I was going to take it apart piece by piece. Because I'd say, if you say, it's really, I guess, the grammar of it. Because if I said, you know, subtract, if I gave you an example and I said subtract, you would automatically put a minus sign as you do it. But you're actually saying subtract, subtract. You're actually saying, when you say the word subtract, you're saying minus. And then when you put the minus sign, you're actually saying minus, minus. So, you know, it's the grammar of it. But I was going to delve into a little different aspect of it, an actuality of using a return loss bridge, and how, you know, what happens if we do it math, what the math is, and how it comes out if, for instance, we did it in an actual case. I would ask you what you would think if I gave you an actual working situation, Dick. Over.
This reminds me a little bit of a problem I ran into in college. I knew how to make it work right, but I didn't memorize it exactly the way the prof wanted it. There was a particular mathematical equation that was taken in this electronic course, where I made the mistake of writing down the words of what to do to make it come out right. You had to find the difference between A and B. And I basically said you can either subtract B from A, or you can change the sign of B and add them to come up with the exact same answer. If you zoom back far enough, it's the exact same process. Well, I got docked on that one. He says, no, if you're going to find the difference between the two, you've got to subtract one from the other and obey the sign. And I said, if I change the sign of the right one and add them, aren't I doing the same thing? I get the right answer. He says, yeah, but you did it by the wrong process. It's a philosophy of life, of whether or not you have enough understanding of what's going on. There's a number of equations that I use every day that I do not have memorized. but I know what the process has to be, and I can re-derive it a hell of a lot faster than I can try to remember it by memorization, if you know what I mean. Let me let Wesley ask at least one more of his questions. Wesley, N2XJN, go right ahead. K2RIW and the Tech Man.
Okay, N2XJN. Quickly, I took apart one of the directional couplers. What I find out is that I have three BNC connectors, which one is coupling, one is out, one is in, and inside there were two tiny thyroid coils, one resistor and one adjustable capacitor. Everything is very carefully done. Now, my question was, the A1 type of modulation is CW, A2 is CW modulated, and A3 is AM modulation with two sidebands and a carrier. A3J is SSB with 10% carrier. My question was, if I take CW, which is A1, and I modulate that with the pulse modulator, would that be considered square wave as a pulse with no harmonic pursuit?
I think the answer is no. First of all, in those original designations that used to be used in the United States, and for some reason they made them a hell of a lot more complicated, I don't understand that. There used to be A1, 2, 3, 4, and I think A5 was pulse, or was it P1, 2, 3. There really was a separate designation for pulse. However, if I take any CW carrier and modulate it in any way, angular or amplitude, phase or amplitude, if I make any change of a completely continuous CW carrier, slowly increase it, rapidly increase it and decrease it with amplitude modulation, increase it and decrease it even faster and faster and more severe until it becomes a square wave, a triangle wave, or whatever. Any method of modulation of a CW signal will, by definition, create, in general, upper and lower sidebands in a very predictable manner called the Fourier series. You can't avoid that. Let me drop. You cannot create a rate of modulation that does not create a sideband. If I modulate with a sine wave of 10 kilohertz, my amplitude of my 1 megacycle carrier, I will be creating an upper sideband and a lower sideband exactly 10 kilohertz away if I'm modulating it with 10 kilohertz. If I'm modulating it with a sine wave of 10 kilohertz, if I'm looking at a square wave, a 10 kilohertz square wave, just a square wave directly into an oscilloscope coming out of a pulse generator, it will have all the odd harmonics if the square wave is thoroughly symmetrical, 50% of the time up, 50% of the time down. It'll have all the odd harmonics. A 10 kilohertz square wave will have 10, 30, 50, 70, 90, 110 kilohertz sideband above and below. Can't avoid that. When I use that square wave to modulate a carrier, like a 1 megacycle signal, all of those sidebands will be superimposed on that carrier. Can't avoid that. There's zillions and zillions of people who thought they're going to choose some exotic kind of modulation and not make sidebands. Mother Nature won't let you do that. She always creates sidebands. There is no method of modulation that's not going to make your signal more wide and have more components to it.
Can I then ask you, what is then the difference between A3, which is AM, and A2, which is the modulated CW?
In the case of modulated CW, the carrier is continuously there, and you do or don't add the tone to it. That's A2. A1 is where the complete carrier goes on and off. A2 is a tone on the carrier that goes on and off. A3, you're asking what's the difference between A2 and A3. A2 usually is Morse code. A3 is usually something like broadband audio.
Yes.
Okay, does that sort of answer the question?
Oh, no, it is not. It is just that A1 is the carrier by itself and is detected by the detector of the receiver. Now, the A2 is the carrier that is modulated with, let's say, 100 hertz or 1 kilohertz, whatever, and then if you break the carrier at the same time, when you break the modulation, then you've got the pulse. Now, if the A2 will behave the way that you described, then we will have A3, because then A3 has the presence of the carrier and two side mounts. Back to you.
Okay, A1, if you hold the key down, is one single tone, no sideband. When you start sending A1 Morse code, depending on your dot and dash rate, you're generating side lobes, which is proportional to the rate. My understanding of A2 is that the carrier stays on continuously, and the tone you're adding to the carrier goes on and off with the Morse code.
No, that's not true. You can have it this way, which was used in the Army of Poland and Russia, that you break down the carrier and the tone at the same time. Back to you.
Okay, I'm going to accept that. So, the advantage of A2 is you don't need a product detector to make the carrier into a tone. In the case of A1, you have to have something like a beat frequency oscillator or a product detector to make your Morse code into a tone that goes on and off, that comes out of the earphones. In the case of A2, no product detector is required. Ordinary amplitude detecting will give you a tone that goes on and off into the earphones with A2. Go ahead.
MCW.
Glenn wanted to say something?
I think that was Mel who said that modulated CW. Is that what you said, Mel?
If you remember back in the old days, that's what was authorized on 2 meters. You wanted to send CW on 2 meters back in the days when we were running AM on 2 meters. Used MCW. That was its derivation. It was only authorized on, I think, from 140 and up. You cannot run MCW down any lower. So that's how they got the derivation MCW. Dick, you had a continuous carrier, and basically you could have a microphone sitting there and with a code oscillator over.
Yeah, but what Wesley is saying, he believes that in MCW, the modulation is there to make a tone out of the earphone on the transmitter, and he believes the carrier can be turned on and off. In the modulated CW you're talking about, did the carrier stay on and only the tone modulating the carrier, only that tone went on and off? Back to you, Mel.
Basically, that's the way it was. It was like sitting a microphone by the speaker of a code oscillator. That was MCW. You pick up the mic and then talk, because that's what a lot of people, of course, were using on 2 meters. I mean, you used only two modes at that time on 2 meters. It's before the days of FM, actually. And you used either AM modulation or you used MCW. And MCW was basically you put the mic down and you send CW with your cold practice oscillator right there, over.
And to AGM. It is true to the A3, which is AM. What you're actually doing, instead of talking, you're sending the signal. This is A3, not A2. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, we've got a little bit of a conflict here. Mel, was there ever a kind of tone put onto the carrier where the carrier itself was turned on and off? And if so, was that some of the A number? Back to you, Mel. Okay, so I think your network is telling us not in this country, according to the FCC. Got any further comments on that one, Mel?
2-2-2-2.
Mel first, and then go ahead, Mel.
Okay, back in the old days, no, as far as I know, there was the only way that you could send CW at that time on 2 meters. Was by MCW. If they had any other exotic systems of breaking the carrier or something, I don't know. Of course, like you said, A1 is classic CW. A2 was classic AM and MC, and then there was MCW. That's the way their derivation was, MCW, Dick, over.
And it was in whole Europe. A1 was non-modulated signal. A2 was the modulated CW when you break the carrier and you break the tone at the same time. When you could break with your key,